I'm joined now by Paralympian and friend of Phoenix FM, Jonathan Adams. Welcome back to studio, mate. And I was looking, don't think you've been in here since the middle of 2016. Time really flying. How's it all going in general?
Yeah, it's good to be back, Chris. Thanks. It's definitely been a while, but it feels like second home, really, coming back and being here is just no different. It's just the same place I remember before. But yeah, a lot's changed since I was last here. A lot of things happened around the time of Rio, and to be honest, I wasn't really sure whether my athletics career would continue past 2016. But luckily, I began working with a new coach, Emeka Uduchukwu, who's a former British Olympian. He competed in Athens in 2004 in the discus for GB. And I already knew of him because he was a Loughborough graduate like myself. And I just felt with the circumstances I was in, things couldn't get much worse. So I saw the only way was up, really.
So, not to go all cliche on it, but it's been a real roller coaster ride for you since you were last with us in the middle of 2016. So, to give everyone a bit of background, you're diagnosed with cerebral palsy at 18 months, went on to take up the shot put and discus, and specialising in shot put, made the GB team for the 2012 Games. All good so far, but then you had some major surgery that put you back a bit, changed classification from seated to standing thrower, then came the problem with your leg brace, which was the main, I think, one of the main routes to fall backwards. Definitely. Tell us a little bit what happened there.
Well, I was wearing a bespoke orthotic that was made by Dorset Orthopaedic and Otterbock back in 2014-15 to aid my walking, as my conditions gets progressively worse with time and with age. So with the amount of walking I was doing at university, I sort of felt it was paramount that I had something to aid my walking, because it was affecting my training, it was affecting my day-to-day life, and I just became very dependent on it. And this device worked brilliantly. My walking had improved, my efficiency, my energy levels were all much better. But then disaster struck. One training session, I was walking from the outside area at Loughborough back to my home, and my splint completely shattered whilst I was wearing it. And as a consequence of that, how bad my walking had got, I ended up doing significant damage to my right patella tendon, and it went misdiagnosed by the governing body specialists at the time, which was disappointing. We knew that there was a problem there, but it was so difficult to pin why it was happening that I subsequently wasn't able to compete that season, really. Although I made a best go of it, and I didn't get selected for World Championships, lost my funding, and then it kind of snowballed into 2016, really.
You mentioned there the injury, but you managed to find a new partner to work with in the London Orthotic Consultancy. So how did that all start?
Basically, I was working with a mainstream orthotist and prosthetist producer that's widely known in kind of para sport, if you like, across all different events, all different sports. And I went to them under the impression that a friend of mine, Alid Davis, who's a Welsh Paralympian, multiple Paralympic champion, world champion in the shot and discus, he was wearing a brace that was similar to something that I trialled before. And I'd seen the improvement that it had given him in terms of stability. Now, that's one of the main areas that I'd struggled with when it came to my throwing, which is why I went to a seated throw to begin with after surgery. And it didn't work out, the partnership. And I came away, as I say, from that whole experience with no funding, no support mechanism, no real backbone, if you like. And it was sort of through Phoenix FM and yourself and other friends that I kind of, you know, managed to find good people. And I approached the LOC myself and said, look, this is what I've got to offer. Is there any way in which you can help me? And I went to see them in the latter end of the season in 2015. So it would have been around July, August time. Got fitted, got measured, and then I think it was May or April of this year, I collected my carbon splint that I use today, still use now. And it's been a long journey, but without them, I definitely wouldn't be anywhere close to where I am now, really.
So they provide you with your walking splint and your competition?
Just the competition splint,
just the competition one at the moment. Because, I mean, what has it allowed you to do then that you couldn't do before?
It's just given me stability. So when I was throwing the shot, I was able to throw it at the time a reasonable distance, but I would be forever falling over. So it's not all well and good being able to throw, say, 12.5 metres, but if you're falling over while you're doing it, it's not going to count for anything. So I had to find a way to which I could maximise my potential whilst still being within the rules of the sport, within the rules of the event, and also making sure I'm safe and able to compete. Because if I'm subjecting my body to falling over all the time, then my career is going to be cut short. And obviously, being a disabled athlete, that's not something that I want to take into, you know, consideration, because it's something that could affect my walking as well. So I thought, you know, something has to change here. And the LOC specialist David Williams, who made my brace, he saw how I was throwing, and we spoke with my old coach and with my agent, and it was basically something had to change. And from, I'd say, the latter end of last year, everything just started afresh really for this season.
Well, because you were still, while all this was still going on and you were having problems with your old brace and problems with the splint, you were still trying your hardest to make it for Rio at the time. I mean, you were doing that without a splint, you were doing that without a brace at all, weren't you, when you were throwing? So, I mean, you kind of learned how to throw all over again about three or four times, haven't you?
Yeah, I had splint. I was wearing the splint, trialing the splint. It was being changed here, there, and at the end of the day, I just had no technique to speak of. I was confused. I felt very lost. And my previous partners did everything they could to kind of provide me with the best support possible. But I think because I was going through coaching changes, as I say, I lost all my funding. I was kind of a lone ranger, if you like. There was nothing really that I could speak to them about that I wasn't already feeling myself. So I think it made it quite difficult trying to build something around my functionality rather than how my disability actually affects me. And it was difficult. And as you say, I think the one thing that I've had to learn, and I'm learning now, is there's always room for improvement, whether good or bad. It's still going to help improve you in the long run, whether it's through character building or through technical efficiency. So whilst it's been a tough journey and still is tough to this day, I think it stood me in good stead, really.
Now, you didn't make it for Rio, you weren't selected, but I know you were being very realistic about that. In your heart of hearts, you knew that you weren't probably going to make it, did you? I mean, did you watch Rio, or was it that something you thought, I'm not there, I'm not going to watch it at all?
I watched parts of it. I tried to get involved in where I want to be involved. So, for example, if an Olympics is on, for example, I will watch some of the track and field, but I won't watch all of it just because I do athletics. You know, I'm not one of these people that likes to get like a sponge and just soak everything in. I'm very much keep myself to myself and focus on what I feel is right for me. So whether it's something that people agree with or whether it's not, I feel that I'm the only one in control of what I do on a day-to-day basis. So if I'm not doing what's best for me, then I shouldn't be doing it at all, really. So I think I just kind of watched over my event to see whether it had advanced, and it had for Rio. It was, some of the distances were quite extraordinary, really, and went on to do even more so in London. So I knew where the yardstick could move, so to speak. But yeah, I think it's best to be realistic. Like, we've all got aspirations and obviously dreams of getting somewhere, but I think if you set yourself up to fail, then it will hit you 10 times harder as if you're realistic. But never lose sight of what you're working to. Just don't kind of sell it for more than what it is, I suppose.
Was it more disappointing then to miss out on the 2017 IPC World Championships because it would have been back in the Olympic Stadium where you were for 2012? And because you'd had sort of that extra year to go on from when everything had kind of hit rock bottom?
I don't think so. I think, at the end of the day, I'm an athlete, that's first and foremost, and whenever I get an opportunity to compete, it's an opportunity to showcase something that otherwise might not be seen in the public eye. It might not be something that people think that disabled people can necessarily do. So I think regardless of where the competition is, it wouldn't really change my opinion as to whether I want to qualify for it. Obviously, the fact it was in London, it kind of had a bit of a bearing on it because it was back in the stadium where obviously I competed in London, and there was kind of added bonuses, if you like, with it being a home games. You get all the sort of home exposure that I think fizzles out very quickly after the event, and I don't think it's very well sustained for even the top athletes, which is a real shame. But for me, competition's competition. I could be, you know, as we've said before, down a track with parents and somebody's dog, and I'd still give it 110% as if I was, like you say, competing in a world championship. For me, competition is competition.
So I know we can't foresee the future, but How much more confident are you now looking at this next cycle and looking towards, I suppose, the ultimate goal is Tokyo 2020?
Yeah, well, I was saying to my coach yesterday, I had a meeting with a potential new therapist who I'm going to be adding to my team in the new year, that I feel I've learned more in the last 12 weeks than I have in the past sort of 3 years of being a standing thrower since my reclassification. And I think it's only because now I'm starting to understand the flaws in my technique, where I need to improve, whereas before I think I was almost leaning on the other people to kind of feed me that information, and they in turn expected me to know how to work with it. Whereas now my coach, he came and met me and just said, look, we need to start from scratch. You know, he said, I'm not really sure how you've been successful in your career to this point. Bear in mind, in that time I'd been to European final, come fourth in the final, had a career ranking of number three in the world. And to hear that was kind of shocking, to know that he thought it was that bad. Like, I knew it was bad, but I didn't quite think it would be, you know, quite so shocking. But at the same time, that sort of lesson has kind of blown the cobwebs off and allowed us to start from scratch again. And this season just gone, I was actually throwing just as far from a very basic technique as opposed to the quite complex non-functional technique I was using last season, the season before. So this is sort of, I feel like I'm starting my career again at 25, which is quite weird, but I think it has to happen in order for me to have a realistic chance for the future.
Well, because you mentioned your new coach there, but you've got a new person on strength and conditioning side as well.
I did have, so I was working with Daniel Taylor before, who is based at my local training facility that I use, Sudbury Rugby Club. I've got a partnership with them and with another partner of mine to use their facilities and all that sort of thing. So I worked with him on the principle that, as I say, I was coming from a background of basically having everything on my doorstep. Everything was very controlled when you're on funding because you've got, in theory, the world's best people looking after your welfare, obviously at different tiers of support, but the infrastructure was in place. Whereas when I came back home, because I live in Suffolk, there's not a great deal around the local area where people have got the time or the expertise that might be required. So he came on board, basically got me through to my injury in 2015, which unfortunately wasn't anything to do with mistraining. It was purely circumstantial. And then I worked with him up until Rio last year, and he then moved away to start a new business elsewhere. And that's when myself and my coach sat down and just said, look, this is what our plan's going to be. This is how we want to sort of carry it out. And it's gone from there, really. So my coach is overseeing pretty much everything. And then we're tapping into, like I say, other people that we've got involved where we need them, really.
You're listening to Phoenix FM and Phoenix Sport on this Saturday afternoon with myself, Chris Hood, joined by Paralympian Jonathan Adams. We're talking the lead up to Tokyo 2020, which is closer than you think in an Olympic cycle. And we've been talking about how the last couple of years since he was last on this station have gone. And we were mentioning there, Jonathan, new brace, new coaches, new agent as well.
Yeah, new agent. Cut a long story short, when I lost my funding, I felt that I had no one really representing myself as an athlete and as a person apart from my mum and dad. And I think when I've raised concerns, not just about sport in general, but myself and how I want to perceive myself in the public eye, I think people see it as a vehicle in order to gain things personally. So in order to get you in a team or whatever, there's no one from the outside looking at it from a professional point of view where they can support you where necessary but also not support you if need be. And friend of the show, Ronnie O'Sullivan, I met him last year or year before, and we'd spoken at length through his interest in athletics about my situation, and we became good friends. And one of his former agents approached me through speaking with Ronnie, and we decided to see whether a partnership could be made. And so far it's been successful, and he's supported me in a lot of other areas outside of athletics as well. So it's just, I would say, made my life a little bit more professional. I'm able to actually speak to someone now who can take control of things that I shouldn't have to worry about as an athlete, and just kind of give me the confidence that if I need to pick up the phone and talk to somebody from a outside point of view who understands sport and business, then I can do that without having to worry about what they'll think about what I'll say. They'll just treat it as black and white and give me relevant advice.
The man's name, Django Fung, who is rather famous, or should it be infamous, in the world of snooker, perhaps. There is a massive crossover for you and the snooker, because you were formerly a director of the World Disability Billiards and Snooker, and you helped them develop their classification system, didn't you?
Yeah, myself and Matt Hewitt, who is the WPBSA media officer, took that on board ourselves as the body kind of grew bigger. So we already had an infrastructure in place from the EFDS, which is the England Federation of Disability Sport, but we felt it was rather outdated and didn't really take into consideration how classification is now widely viewed across many sports. So with my expertise in the sense of being an international athlete since 2009 and having a disability and also playing snooker myself, it seemed only natural that we would combine together and try to sort of realign what the classification should be for the snooker players who are involved in the body.
So there's been a lot of focus on classification in disability sport recently, and for those who don't know, could you explain first of all what classification is?
Well, classification, I think in black and white, is basically the only way to which athletes with a disability can be eligible to compete in competition, because there's so many varieties of disability. It's not a case of the best 100-metre runners in the world will be at the Olympics. It doesn't work like that. And I think because it's so complex, the only way in which it can be quantifiable in the way that it is, with the amount of numbers, is to have the system that's in place. So it's across a whole different range. Just every sport has their own classification code, if you like, which is governed by the IPC, who are the International Paralympic Committee. And they've kind of set standards for international classification. And then countries and sports alike can kind of derive from that and create something for national classification that gets athletes introduced into sport along the same code as the international stage. And then if they progress upwards, then they obviously go on to the higher level. So it's kind of almost like an encyclopedia of disability that is then related to sport to make it as fair and as equal as possible.
I mean, it's quite a complex system because, I mean, the categories are differing from sport to sport depending on how your disability would affect your ability to do that sport, aren't they?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what you just said there is probably the most crucial element of the whole classification kind of landscape in a sense. So when it came to snooker, there was a lot of people who were classifying themselves based on what their disability actually is. So, okay, myself, I'm a quadriplegic cerebral palsy, so all four limbs of my body are affected, but only my left side really affects me the most. So if I was to self-classify, I would say I'm a diplegic because only one side of my body is mainly affected, but I'm actually medically diagnosed as a quadriplegic. So you get that confusion. And what it came down to in the snooker, I said the best way to make it simple and accessible for all people, not just snooker players, is to make it based on their functionality when they play the sport, not what their disability actually is. So we had many people come in who believed they were one group, and then once we'd seen them play in competition, we actually suggested that they might be in something different. And I think it can only be judged upon how their condition affects them when they partake in the sport relative to the people who are already in that classification or what that classification stands for. Because there's always going to be extremities to the rule. There's always going to be people that perhaps shouldn't be there, or people who only just sort of slot in, if you like. But it kind of, it's almost like the top has to say what it says, and then from the way down, it then has to fit what it's currently managed as, and that's obviously the people who are in the event to begin with. So it is tricky though in all sorts of sport, because it's so down to interpretation and based upon how the classifiers in international cases see the athlete.
I mean, and your classification won't necessarily stay the same, because we mentioned in the intro there you went from an F34 seated shot put to an F35 standing. So I mean, you do make those sort of changes. So it's just one of those things. Probably the public needs greater understanding. I wanted to touch also on evaluation, because am I right in thinking you're regularly seen by classification panels as well, aren't you?
They're always there, so they'll always be at international competitions, because if there's any protests that are made by other countries or indeed a national country, they have to then take that into consideration, assess the athlete, go back through their medical records, perhaps assess them again formally. But once you've got a classification, if it's a confirmed class, you won't be touched unless your condition changes or you're protested. So in my case, when I was younger, before I had my surgery in 2006 to 2010, I was an F35 athlete as I am now. But then following the surgery, obviously my circumstances had changed and it wasn't feasible for me to compete standing anymore. So we put in a almost like an appeal, if you like, to change classification, which, as I'm aware of, my classification being F35 is the only classification that's allowed to go to a seated throw if they deem it necessary. So we went to that. It was in Switzerland in 2014. In 2011 it was in Dubai. I was reclassified into 2014 and competed for 3 years as a seated athlete. And then, as I say, in 2014 was reclassified to an F35 again.
Now back to snooker, and it's an absolute feast at the moment, isn't it? There seems to be a snooker event every single week. I think there's about four in this month alone, isn't there?
Yeah, it's been mad. It's been crazy. But to be honest, I think, as many say, the opportunities are there, and I think the wealth of tournaments has affected some players, but it's also, you know, made new players come in and kind of evolve. You've seen Yan Bingtao, young Chinese player from Sheffield, or obviously from China but based in Sheffield, do superbly well. We've got Cao Yupeng at the moment in the semi-final, and I think what it's doing is it's opening a world where no player is safe anymore. We saw Ding Junhui go out in the opening round of the UK Championship, and I think whilst the system is extreme from my point of view, it's thrown up a lot of surprises and actually shows how strong the tour is as a whole, from the number one down to the 128. So I think it's thrown up a lot of good talking points in the sense of we're seeing new players emerge that perhaps we would never have seen before with how the tour used to be. But equally, I see that some of the top players who are having to travel far and wide to compete in these tournaments are obviously some of them are falling by the wayside when they come up against players who perhaps don't have the finances to fly to these other tournaments around the world. And as you've said, all players are obviously at a certain standard, otherwise they wouldn't be on the tour.
Mutual friend of ours, Ronnie O'Sullivan, he's right back in it. And because he didn't do tournaments for a while and seems to be better than ever. We won't mention what happened last night because it didn't go well against John Higgins. But even despite that, he's right up in there, and his run of tournaments in the last couple of months has been incredible.
Well, I think the one thing that people will appreciate with top-class sportsmen and women is they can never be wrote off, and they can never be sort of taken as granted. I mean, I remember Roger Federer a few years was contemplating retirement after back problems, and he was changing his rackets left, right and centre. Obviously Tiger Woods has just returned to golf, Rafa Nadal as well to tennis. So these are global sporting icons that people perhaps thought it's in their best days, in a sense, and they've gone off and done other things, like Ronnie was doing his American work with Eurosport. He was doing all the exhibitions, and people perhaps thought that was it, he was past his best. But I think the one thing that I've learned as an athlete is this: the form is temporary and class is permanent. And for people like that, same with Michael Phelps, I think he was the biggest testament to that when he had a bad competition come back and did so well in Rio and signed off on his terms. I think that was beautiful to see. And I think the one thing that I think a lot of people don't see is because they only see them on the TV, in the papers, in the stories about who they are, they don't actually understand what it takes to be at the top of your sport every time you go out onto the field of play. And it's inevitable that you're going to lose because the rest of the world are just that good in a lot of other sports. But I think people are too quick to judge on how people perform instead of actually trying to get inside the mind of what it must be like to perform in four tournaments on the bounce, being the world's best players or having to travel around the world. And people think it's easy, and yes, you get a lot of benefits that come with it, but it is difficult, it is lonely, it is difficult, and it is tough. And I think it's more of a mental strength of character that helps you get through that rather than your actual ability to play in a certain field of play.
How much longer is he going to go on for? I suppose that's the golden question, isn't it?
In Ronnie's case,
I don't think Ronnie knows.
No, I don't think he ever will. I think there'll come a time where perhaps he's either forced out of the game because the rest of the world are just that good and he doesn't feel he can compete with them, because he sets himself standards that I don't think anyone else will set for themselves. I think everybody obviously wants to get to a certain level, but his level is there and then way beyond it. And I think he's never satisfied unless he feels he reaches that level. So I think until he kind of makes up his own mind as to when he feels is right. I don't think we should ever kind of speculate, because like you say, you just never know. And I think whilst he's enjoying his snooker, which is the most important thing, like for me in my athletics, I think you don't want to predict the future, because you'd rather just stay in the moment and enjoy it for what it is, knowing how difficult in my case it's been. There was days where I just didn't want to get up and train, because I knew that how emotionally broken I was from the experiences I've had. But now I've kind of got my motivation back, I've got good people around me, and I kind of feel like I'm on a journey of rediscovering myself again, and it's paying dividends in my athletics. It's still not where I want it to be at this stage, but my coach has taught me that time is the greatest blessing that I can have, and through having the right people, I don't tend to put sort of time on anything, because it's a naturally occurring process. And I feel, for as long as I feel I've got the ability to perform, people can say what they want, but I'm not going anywhere yet.
So will he do the jungle?
Oh, I don't know. I couldn't do it.
Could you? That was my follow-up question. Would you do the jungle?
Never.
You get to the Tokyo 2020 Olympics. You win your gold, and the offer comes in.
No.
All right, I'll throw the offer out. Say the programs are both going. You can either go jungle, or you can do a Johnny Peacock and do Strictly. You have to pick one.
I had to pick one. I suppose public humiliation in the jungle wouldn't be so bad, because everybody's in the same boat, and what they do to people on there is quite horrific, and it's not something I would want to do. But if I was to humiliate myself dancing, I don't think I'd ever let it down, really. So I think I'd probably go for the jungle on that one.
Jonathan Adams, thank you very much.